Well, 1903, the year of this story, was the year of the pogrom in Kishinev, a ferocious display of anti-Jewish violence. In Warsaw also, anti-Semitism was on the rise. The Dreyfus case was ongoing in Paris, and blood libel of the kind that Joseph addresses was unfortunately not a figment of the Jewish imagination.
Welcome to the Stories Jews Tell, a weekly podcast with Professor Ruth Weiss, brought to you by the Tikva Fund. This week we'll be reading stories by Yitzhak Leibush Peretz. This season of the Stories Jews Tell is sponsored by Robert L. Friedman.
Our story today is called Stories, in Yiddish, Mises, written in 1903 by one of the great Yiddish and Hebrew writers, Yitzhak Leibush Peretz, I.L. Peretz, and here we're using the translation of Maurice Samuel. As the title leads us to expect, the main character is a writer of stories, though we're not sure of what kind. If you've been watching programs like Unorthodox, you will recognize certain features about our protagonist. He grew up in a traditional Jewish home, in a traditional Jewish community, but then broke away when he felt that he couldn't stand it any longer. We meet this young man several years after he has made his break from home, living in a rooming house in Warsaw and trying to make it as a writer. Now, Peretz himself had covered some of that same ground without the rebellion. Born in the Polish city of Zamość, 1852, he moved to Warsaw, the Polish capital, in 1890, and died there in 1915 at the beginning of the First World War. He had qualified and practiced for a time as a lawyer, but spent most of his life at the heart of the Warsaw Jewish community, working from 8 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon for the local Jewish community council, and turning to his literary work after that. Peretz had actually begun writing in Polish before becoming a Hebrew poet, and then turning almost exclusively to Yiddish, which was the main language of Poland's 3 million Jews. Warsaw, the Polish capital, was then about one-third Jewish, so that Yiddish writers had a large local readership, as well as by then many thousands of readers overseas, including here in America. Warsaw was a large open city, almost as cosmopolitan as New York. Jews and Christian Poles were very much aware of one another, and though the two communities were still largely separate, many of the young educated Jews were becoming acculturated. The 51-year-old Peretz, who wrote this story, was by then the most prominent Jewish cultural figure in Poland, an influential editor, political columnist, founding inspiration for the Yiddish theater, a Jewish choir, Jewish orphanages, and much more. He was also a prolific essayist, poet, dramatist, and most especially, a writer of stories. Being at the center of Jewish life and culture, he felt the buffeting forces from all sides, and he became increasingly concerned about the prospects for Jews in the modern world. Mises, stories, that is to say, this story, grows out of those anxieties. Now, the main plot is about our unnamed young man, whom I will call Joseph for the sake of clarity. Joseph has met a young woman, an almost illiterate Polish seamstress, who does not like Jews, yet loves the stories that Joseph invents for her. She wants all her fairy tales to have happy endings, and since her favors depend on his ability to satisfy her, he has to make up the kind of stories that she asks for. Now, one of the stories that he spins out is a fairy tale that he intends to tell her when she comes to his room later that day. Of course, he will be telling it in Polish, since that is how they communicate. He has several languages. She has only that one. The day of our story happens to be Passover, which was also the time that he had left his parents' house. Joseph is living on a shoestring, and he is weakened by hunger and loneliness. Awareness of Passover triggers memories of home and associations with the holiday. The combined physical weakness and emotional stress cause a nervous breakdown in which he imagines other kinds of stories about the threat to Jews. We are left to wonder which, if either, of these two kinds of stories Joseph will ever choose to write. Okay, now let's put some meat on these bare bones by filling in the substance of our story. It opens as Joseph awaits the arrival of the seamstress, whom he had met the previous spring in Warsaw's public garden. She lives with her mother, a spiteful woman who hates Jews, so he can never visit her in her room. She has to visit him. And that morning, he had received her note saying that she would come by later that day. Her note was written, we are told, like Noach mit sieben Greisen, Noah with seven mistakes. Now that's the common Yiddish description of someone who is illiterate. The biblical name Noach has only two letters, Nun and Chet. My teacher in elementary school once delightfully demonstrated to our class how one can write it with seven mistakes. And those who know Yiddish Hebrew alphabet may want to try it for themselves. It's quite hilarious. But here on the second page of our story, our narrator, writing as one Jew to another, reveals that Joseph is attracted to a Polish woman who is not only anti-Semitic, but can hardly read or write her own language. He tells her the story, and only if it seduces her does she allow herself to be kissed. Since that morning, Joseph has been anxiously composing a story to have it ready for her when she arrives. It features a princess who is stranded on a mountain waiting for her rescuer. Now, Nachman of Bratslav, our last week's author, actually composed such stories where every detail had some higher symbolic significance. But Joseph puts this material to quite another use. He places a huge snake at the bottom of the mountain to block the path of the prince who is coming to free the princess. A crow flies ahead of the prince, pointing the way, but the crow vanishes, and the prince grows very hungry as he treks along under the beating sun. When the prince sees a peasant girl with a loaf of fresh bread, he begs her for a piece. She will give it to him only on condition that he marry her. So he does. By the time the crow reappears, the prince has fallen terribly sick from having eaten fresh bread on an empty stomach. Trapped in that village, in that marriage, he becomes a teacher of local children, and meanwhile, the princess is without a savior. As Joseph spins his tale, we note how he resembles his prince, as in the fact that both of them are hungry, and both of them ensnared by women who exploit their weakness. The story starts getting more complicated. The schoolteacher prince grows weak, and when he realizes that he is dying, he divulges his mission to his four students. After his death, they take up the challenge, but following the classic pattern of folk tales, they also encounter obstacles. And just like their teacher, one by one, they fall prey to different witches' temptations. As they climb the mountain, the voluptuous student is seduced by irresistible food. The intellectual is captivated by an irresistible book. And the aesthete is distracted by incredible beauty. The fourth must be her redeemer. But Joseph is reluctant to let him reach his goal. Letting him reach the princess is going to make him miserable. Yet, unless he gives his seamstress her happy ending, he will not get his reward. Will Joseph be true to his creative instincts, or will he invent the story to satisfy her? If we pause to consider what we have so far, we recognize in Joseph what came to be known as masochism, the derivation of pleasure from one's own pain and humiliation. Alone, friendless, our lonely Jew is drawn to a no less lonely woman. Now look, there might be nothing wrong with a utilitarian, transactional relationship between man and woman, except that the romantic, erotic expectations on his side are met by a lack of mutual respect on hers. The term masochism was drawn from the work of Leopold von Sacher-Masoch, a writer a generation older than Peretz, but from the same border region of Austria and Poland, whose novels had described versions of that same unhealthy relationship. This theme of sexual humiliation was in the air. Heinrich Mann's German novel Professor Unrat, which was the basis of the later film The Blue Angel, was published in 1905, 2 years after Peretz wrote this story. Masochism was associated with Jews who were prepared to turn themselves inside out to satisfy hostile Gentiles, with men who turned themselves inside out to satisfy unresponsive women, and with physically insecure writer intellectuals who are attracted to those who reject and wound them. In Joseph, all these features converge. Although he is more than a study in masochism, his attraction to this hostile woman seems traceable to his guilty escape from his Jewish mother. He may be punishing himself for having betrayed his loving mother by enslaving himself to a woman who rejects him. This we learn as Peretz now pivots to the second part of his story to fill in some background. The first Passover after Joseph left home, he almost went out of his mind with homesickness. So the second year, he decided to return home for the holiday. He stuck it out at the Passover Seder until the recitation of the 10 plagues and the Shvoich HaMoscho, Shvoich HaMatcha, the prayer that calls on God to pour out thy wrath on the nations that did not know you. That was his breaking point. He couldn't stand that reactionary aggression against the Gentiles. And he left the next day without saying goodbye. His mother came to the station to see him off, but after that he never returned. I think Peretz got that detail right. That was precisely the passage that troubled liberal Jews and sensitive souls who could not tolerate what sounds like vengeance, no matter how rarely Jews uttered such thoughts. And I believe you will try in vain to find that Shvoich HaMatcha in any liberal editions of the Haggadah. It's now several years since that departure from home, and Joseph wouldn't have known that it was Passover at all had the cashier in the cafe where he had a roll and coffee that morning, all that he could afford for breakfast, had that cashier not commented that the weather was turning nasty, as it always does on their Easter. Joseph realizes. So that's why there was so much commotion in his neighborhood that morning. It was the eve of Passover. He laughs, thinking that somewhere in his soul, some ancestral spirit must be lying in wait for him. The weather had turned nasty, so that by the time he reaches his rooming house, Joseph is quite drenched, and climbing the stairs, he begins to feel sick. Suddenly he stops. In a dark corner of the stairwell, he sees a Seder table, all decked out, and a woman with her back to him lighting the candles. She's about to turn around. He recognizes his mother. She had sent him knitted socks to keep him warm. But before he can see her face, he realizes that he is imagining things and climbs the rest of the stairs as quickly as he can, regretting that he did not wait to see her face. Once he's back in his room, still thinking of his mother, he envisions a family seated around the large Seder table, dressed in clothing of previous generations. Suddenly, there's a knock at the door. "Open in the name of the law." The people around the table are frightened. The head of the household commands them, "Quick, search under the table." There they discover a dead child. Everyone is terrified. As they hear the front door being broken open, the father commands, "Take the corpse and cut it up." They do so, and everyone takes a piece on his plate. The father orders them, "Eat," and they do. Here I quote, "Police and soldiers burst in then. They look everywhere in vain. They go out raging. And when they are gone, the furious cry of the prayer goes up from the assembly of celebrants. Shvoich HaMoscho al HaGoyim, pour out thy wrath on the nations that know thee not." Not for me, he thinks. That needs a stronger pen than mine. End of quote. This legend is woven from various Jewish tales, but Joseph knows that he cannot go through with writing it. That delicate young man who could not bear the 10 plagues has no stomach for so powerful an ending. So he begins working through another version of the story. Another family at the Seder table, but this time The Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidism, is there as a guest, incognito. This time, before the reading begins, the guest asks that an extra yarmulke be brought to the table, with a white robe, a kittel, like the one that he and the host are wearing. The family nervously obeys. When he has these items, the Baal Shem Tov stamps his foot and says, "Yantik, get up!" And a bloodless corpse of a young man emerges from under the table. The rabbi says, "Sit," and the dead boy obeys. "Open your eyes, put on the robe and the skullcap." And finally he commands, "Yantek, begin reciting the Haggadah with us." End of quote. And thus, when there is once again that pounding at the door and the police enter, they again fail to find the dead corpse that they had planted, and they leave in defeat. The Baal Shem tells the resurrected corpse to close his eyes and return to his place in the cemetery. And, he says, "Because it has been your privilege to wear a Jewish prayer robe and say a Jewish prayer, you may rest in the Jewish cemetery. And when you meet Father Abraham, tell him ... Now, Peretz often ends episodes and stories with ellipses, a series of dots that just trail off, telling you that the episode or that the sentence or that the story is not ended. Joseph's miracle tale trails off just like that. Since these stories only exist in his fever, we cannot know either whether he will ever write them. At that point in our story, Peretz's story, there is a light knock at the door. "Come in," Joseph says. "Got any stories for me?" his visitor asks. "All kinds," he says. "Allerlei." And with that word, "all kinds," Peretz's story ends, leaving unresolved both the fairy tale for the seamstress and whatever Passover stories Joseph intends to write. Peretz also leaves hanging his own work about this Jewish writer who can send his imagination off in different directions, writing in different languages for different audiences. What are we to make of this? What does this talent signify? Well, 1903, the year of this story, was the year of the pogrom in Kishinev, a ferocious display of anti-Jewish violence. In Warsaw also, anti-Semitism was on the rise. The Dreyfus case was ongoing in Paris, and blood libel of the kind that Joseph addresses was unfortunately not a figment of the Jewish imagination. All day, Joseph tries to win his princess, knowing that should he ever reach his seductive goal, it would be his undoing. Then the vision of his mother in the stairwell wakens his protective love of her, and he invents scenarios of how to save the Jews. Both the Passover tales that Joseph composes are fantasies of rescue. Our writer goes from trying to win the love of a Gentile to trying to secure Jewish survival from Gentile assault. How wonderfully strange that the expected knock on the door from the object of his desire should explode in Joseph's imagination as the dreaded banging of the authorities who planted the corpse to trap the Jews. The reminder of Passover triggers both breakdown and a burst of creative energy. How amazing that the same Shvoch HaMatcha, the call for God to punish our enemies that once drove the sensitive young man from his parents' table, should then cry out from his stories to avenge his people. Peretz shows us how the same elements of storytelling can be put to such different uses, how the Jewish writer can turn in such different directions. If we have been waiting for Peretz to seduce us with a happy ending of the kind that the seamstress expects from him, we will be disappointed. Yet, this was a Passover story, written for the Yiddish press that always put out special holiday editions. Writers like Peretz and Sholem Aleichem, whom we are going to be reading next week, composed many such stories for holiday publications. Some were indeed written to make Jews feel good about the holiday. But this one does not satisfy simple expectations because it was not written for the seamstress. The Jewish writer cannot be expected to supply a fairy tale ending. He must try to supply comfort by writing honestly about what he knows. Peretz shows us the limits of Joseph's attempt to find his love in Polish. If our Jewish writer is trying to satisfy a Polish audience that distrusts him to begin with, what can he end up producing? The Hollywood writers, who were writing in a less dangerous environment, still felt obliged to end their Jewish-themed movies with intermarriage, the Jewish prince rescuing the Gentile damsel in non-denominational America. Peretz presents the compromises of the creative Jew who tries to satisfy a non-Jewish or anti-Jewish culture. Joseph leaves his Jewish home to win his freedom, only to lose it in a cultural no-man's land. And there is no way back either, because Jewish life is hard. The pour out thy wrath comes back to haunt Joseph's liberal soul, because that is what exists. The blood libel pursues him. Joseph is a man with a powerful imagination and a weak character, and he may be gaining self-knowledge, but then again, he may not. Peretz does not tell us what kind of stories Joseph will choose to write. And that's it. This is an intriguing story about writing, about internal Jewish conflict, and it may be a good Passover story after all, by telling us what we stand to lose by leaving the Passover table. So that's it for this week. Next week, we will be back with a story of Sholem Aleichem's Dreyfus in Kasrilivke. And for now, I wish you happy reading.